From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about a new study looking at how trauma in kids can change the brain. Then we look at how restaurants have fared during the pandemic and how they're preparing for winter.
In some cases, they're using those portable heaters, which I think we've all become familiar with. A lot of restaurants had started using them during the chillier months in the fall and spring. The other possibility is doing certain structural changes.
Plus, Milwaukee Records Matt Wild talks about some of the new music released by local musicians this month.
I kind of try to round up what I can find every month and just put it all in one big list. Just like, here it is, scroll around and just randomly hit play, and you're going to find something that you like.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Most people will have a traumatic experience at some point in their lives, and some of those people will develop post-traumatic stress disorder. So how do you figure out who is at risk for developing PTSD? That is what Chris Larson's study of acute predictors of long-term post-traumatic outcomes in youth victims of violence aims to figure out. Larson is a professor in the psychology department at UW-Milwaukee. The majority of her research focuses on adults, but she decided to look at how children's brains experience trauma for this study. Larson spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how her study aims to improve the understanding of how trauma looks in an adolescent's brain.
Can you tell me more about this study looking at acute predictors of long-term post-trauma outcomes in youth victims of violence?
Basically, the problem that we're running into with trauma is that lots of people experience trauma. In fact, the vast majority of the population will experience a traumatic event at some point in their lives. And some percentage of that population who experiences trauma will develop PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, but a substantial percentage of people won't. But right now we just don't have a really good way of knowing who's at risk for developing PTSD if they did experience a trauma or not. So we don't know who to intervene with soon after the trauma happens to try and prevent the trauma or prevent PTSD from even happening. And we're focusing on kids who are victims of violence because we know that experiencing assaultive trauma increases your risk for PTSD more than, say, being in a car accident or something that wasn't intentional or wasn't interpersonal. So victims of assaultive trauma, both adults and kids, are at higher risk in a more vulnerable population. So we think it's really important to focus on them so we can identify early predictors of risk for PTSD, things we can identify soon after the trauma happened so that we can hopefully provide interventions in those kids to prevent them developing PTSD at all.
It sounds like the research will cover a lot and a complicated topic at that. How are you going to address all of these different elements within the study?
You're right. It is a complicated project, and we are measuring a complicated phenomenon and with complicated measures and variables. So my focus is on neuroscience and the psychology pieces of this. There's a lot that goes into predicting risk for trauma societally, in the community, in the family, and we will be trying to measure some of those things as well. But our focus is more on the person, on the individual, and their family context. We'll particularly be looking at markers of risk based on what's happening in the brain in terms of emotion regulation. We know from previous work that there's certain networks in the brain, certain structures, certain regions that become dysfunctional when people have PTSD. And we want to investigate whether those regions of the brain start to show dysfunction right away after the trauma, or may already be showing signs of difficulties with emotion regulation from before the trauma even happened. And so if we can assess those neural networks right after the trauma, can dysfunction or dysregulation in those circuits help us predict who is going to go on to develop PTSD? So that's sort of the core of the project, is to do brain imaging, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and focus on those brain networks that might predict risk. And beyond that, we'll be collecting other data, such as cortisol, which is a stress hormone, measures of immune function, which have been linked with stress responding, and then a variety of self-report instruments where the kids and their parents can tell us about how they're functioning, how they're doing, and some other factors in their life that might put them at risk or buffer them from risk, like having strong family or social support. So we are measuring a wide variety of things. It's very complicated, but the core of it is focusing on the brain.
And will you be focusing on youth in Milwaukee, and what age ranges are you considering in this study?
Yeah, absolutely. The sample will be coming from the emergency department at Children's Hospital in Milwaukee. So they're all youth from Milwaukee. And so I should acknowledge my collaborators on this project, since this really is a team effort, since, as you said before, it is pretty complex. The co-principal investigator on this study is Mike Levis, who's a pediatric emergency department physician at Children's, and also involved with Project UGMA, which is a long-standing service at Children's Hospital to provide support for youth victims of violence and their families. So we'll be recruiting participants who come to the emergency room, or emergency department rather, at Frederick, kids who are between the ages of 10 and 16 who've been victims of violence, particularly peer or community violence rather than domestic violence. So yes, all kids from Milwaukee.
And can you tell me a little bit about the grant you received for the work and how it will help the project?
Yeah, absolutely. The funding is critical. So we're hoping to recruit over 5 years, 280 youth who've been victims of violence. And we'll be doing brain imaging, like I mentioned before, at 2 weeks after they've been admitted to the emergency department, again, 3 months later, and then 12 months later. So we're following them longitudinally. And the brain imaging is expensive. Doing this kind of longitudinal study is expensive. So the funding from NIH is critical for that. And it'll go to pay for the personnel to run the study, to pay the participants for their time, for all of the scans.
Why do you think this work is important right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's really shocking how many kids are victims of violence. Actually, when I first started looking into this, because I usually do adult work, I was really troubled by the rates of violence. Some studies say that up to 70% of kids will be victims of violence by the time they hit 18, and that includes both peer and community violence as well as domestic violence. But it's really common. And that type of trauma, as we said before, assaultive trauma can have a big impact. It really can have negative health consequences like PTSD and depression. You know, your point about right now is really relevant because we are in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and that has added a whole nother layer of stress. We are seeing increased rates of domestic violence in particular with people being at home more, although that's not the focus of our study so much, but also just the heightened stress and just feeling negative emotions all the time increases aggression. So it increases violence. So the pandemic has really heightened aggression and violence and made it even a more pronounced problem.
And why did you want to focus on peer and community violence specifically as opposed to domestic violence?
Yeah, that's a good question. We talked about that a lot. You know, obviously all forms of trauma are a problem, and domestic violence is a huge problem that would be of interest to study, and hopefully we'll get to do that in another project. But we weren't able to have enough funds to be able to look separately at both community and peer violence versus domestic violence. And they're really quite different if you think about the context. you know, one, in one situation, the kid is living in the midst of the household where that's going on. And that's a whole additional layer of stress versus more isolated instances of violence that they might experience outside their home, like a more one-off type of a thing. And so they're really different. And we thought it would make the results harder to interpret if we tried to combine these really different types of violence exposures.
What is your personal interest or connection to studying acute predictors of long-term post-trauma outcomes in youth victims of violence?
Yeah, that's sort of been a lifetime of development towards this project, I feel like, in some sense. So I was always really interested in understanding emotion and how people differed in how they react to different situations emotionally, how they can regulate their emotions. You know, people have very different reactions to the exact same thing. And that always really interested me. So I started investigating that when I was still an undergraduate and then after my undergraduate years. And I worked in a lab at the University of Wisconsin at Madison that had a neuroscience focus and really grew to love being able to understand the role of the brain in emotion regulation and how we process emotions. And over time, my interest really gravitated more towards trauma and PTSD, as well as anxiety and depression. You know, everybody has a history of these kinds of disorders in their family. Mine's no exception. My dad was a Vietnam vet and had some early adverse experiences in his childhood. And I saw the toll that PTSD took on him. And I saw that I had an opportunity to understand that better. So my interest in trauma really kept evolving. And then I happened to meet in a totally accidental way one of the key collaborators in my research career, and that's Terry Jeroen Cassini, who's a psychologist in the trauma surgery department at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And so with Terry, we began doing this kind of work in adults where we were recruiting adults from the emergency department and measuring brain activation and other variables soon after the trauma happened to them and following those adults to see if we could figure out what helped predict who would develop PTSD or not. And so working with Terry really solidified my interest in trying to identify these acute post-trauma predictors of risk.
You said a lot of your research has focused on trauma in adults. Why did you decide this time to focus on trauma in children?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. One is we just know a lot less about acute trauma effects in kids. There just hasn't been as much research done on that. And kids are in a really interesting developmental stage in terms of brain development. So we know particularly adolescents, the way their brains are wired, they're at heightened risk for anxiety, for PTSD, for depression. You know, their amygdala, which is really involved in fear and emotional responses, is sort of on overdrive during the teenage years. And their prefrontal cortex, which helps to dampen the amygdala activation and downregulate those emotions, isn't fully developed yet. So they've got like this perfect storm of overactive brain involvement in responding to emotions and an inability to downregulate those emotions. And so we look at them as a really vulnerable population in terms of risk in the face of trauma.
And what do you expect to find as a result of your research?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, we're really focusing a lot on the brain. So we're hoping to identify brain regions that are showing dysfunction soon after trauma that help predict risk for PTSD. And then we can use what we know about those brain regions that predict risk to help us figure out what psychological processes might not be working properly in those kids. Like, is it an ability to downregulate emotions? Is it that their amygdala is so hyperactive that it would be very difficult for the prefrontal cortex to even attempt to downregulate those emotions? Are they having problems with how they focus their attention? Are their attention networks dysfunctional so they can't control their attention and wind up paying too much attention to things that might be threatening or stressful rather than distracting themselves and averting their attention. And so hopefully we can use that brain data to help us identify mechanisms that aren't working right. And then ultimately down the road, this will take some time, of course, but down the road, we could then identify really targeted treatments that really address those mechanisms like attention and how we control attention, for example.
Chris Larson is a professor in the psychology department at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about her study examining acute predictors of long-term post-trauma outcomes in youth victims of violence. What's amazing about the kinds of conversations we have here on Lake Effect is they give thorough and thoughtful context to issues that matter to you. That's what you always get with WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. And it's one of the many reasons that my colleagues and I believe in the coverage we create. We know that you count on our conversations and reporting to give you insight into what's happening in our community. But we can't bring you this essential coverage without your support. Please take a moment to make your contribution to the work of Milwaukee's NPR today during our fall member drive. You can call 877-583-0309. That's 877-583-0309. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or press the red donate button on the app. At a time when so many unprecedented, impactful events are seemingly happening all at once, WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, is really counting on your support to help power the outstanding news coverage that we know you depend on. That number to call is 877-583-0309. Head to our website, wuwm.com/give. And thank you so much for your support. We'll take a short break now, then learn how Milwaukee restaurants are preparing for their first winter during the pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Since the pandemic began, Milwaukee restaurants have found interesting ways to remain open and keep business going. Many of them have relied on an increase in takeout orders. And since this spring, there have been more restaurants offering outside dining. But in Wisconsin, the traditional time for outdoor dining is coming to a close. So where does that leave restaurants that have depended on it as a way to increase capacity? Tom Dakin has been reporting on these issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me now to talk about how restaurants are preparing for their first winter during the pandemic. Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
So, in general, I think people know that they probably haven't been going out to eat as much as they would have in normal times, but restaurants have had a difficult time all around the world because of this pandemic. How are they holding up here in Milwaukee?
Well, unfortunately, you can go to jsonline.com and look at the ever-lengthening list of restaurants that are permanently closing, largely as a result of the pandemic. The National Restaurant Association has estimated something like 30% of restaurants, or I think it might be 30% of independently owned restaurants, could close as a result of this. And that would truly be a loss of a lot of jobs and a lot of revenue that's otherwise pumped into the economy.
There is, of course, a lot that goes into restaurants. As you just said, there's all of the people in the kitchen. There are the people who manage it. There's also, of course, the servers. And right now, that part in particular, the people who are servers, they're having a difficult time because a lot of restaurants haven't opened in that way. So what have restaurants, specifically here in Milwaukee, done to kind of work around the conditions of the pandemic?
Well, they've gone outdoors, and that's been the big change. I mean, aside from obviously carry out and delivery, they've gone to outdoor seating. And sometimes that means if you're lucky enough to have patio space, you use that. It could mean you take a parking lot and convert that into patio space. Within the city of Milwaukee itself, like other communities, both in Wisconsin and elsewhere, there's a program that allows a restaurant to take street parking spaces in front of the restaurant and convert it into outdoor dining space throughout the spring, summer, and fall. And normally in Milwaukee, that program, which runs from March 15th through November 15th, the restaurant has to pay for the privilege of doing that because the city, of course, doesn't want to lose the parking revenue. Because of the pandemic, that payment has been suspended. In addition, the Common Council and Mayor Barrett passed legislation that in some cases allows restaurants to actually take street lanes and convert that into temporary outdoor dining space. Now, that's of course restricted to areas where we don't have heavy traffic, where the speed limit is below 30 miles per hour for safety reasons. But there are a couple of bars and restaurants that have done that. If you were to go down North Old World 3rd Street, for example, near Five Serve Forum, you would see a couple of restaurants and bars along that stretch of street between Juneau Avenue and State Street that have converted part of the traffic lane into outdoor dining space.
Well, and part of the appeal of outdoor dining is that you can more easily comply with the kinds of regulations that these restaurants have to follow right now. Can you explain what some of the rules and regulations are for restaurants that have limited their ability to operate?
Yeah, the biggest restriction is capacity. When the city of Milwaukee, for example, first allowed restaurants to begin reopening, I believe this goes back to about mid-June, it was at 25% capacity. And you think about a small restaurant that has, say, 50 seats, 25% capacity, that's not a lot of seats. You're talking about a dozen seats that you can get in there. Now, that since has been increased, and I believe we're now up to 50% capacity. That's still, again, a substantial reduction from what you would normally have. So by going outdoors, you can add more capacity. You add more capacity, you obviously can add more revenue, particularly on those busy periods on Fridays and Saturdays and weekends. That's what outdoor dining helps you accomplish. In addition, every survey I've seen on this topic since the pandemic has begun has come back and said people just generally feel safer dining outdoors for obvious reasons. We know how COVID-19 generally is spread. It's spread by close contact, and unfortunately, in some cases, it's spread when you're in poorly ventilated areas. Well, if you're outdoors, you've largely eliminated that ventilation problem. And a lot of people just do not want to dine indoors, even at those reduced capacities.
Yeah. But of course, we're coming up to a time in Wisconsin where it's not only less desirable to be outside, but, you know, it's less plausible, less possible.
You don't want to put on your winter parka and go out for a nice 4-course meal? What's wrong with you?
In those temperatures where you're like, I'm not sure if I can breathe safely outside.
Yeah, true story about that. My wife and I and the rest and some of our other family members, we were in Door County, let's see, this would be mid to late September. One of those lovely fall weekends where it was a little chilly. I mean, the seasonal highs every day were probably around 60 degrees. We didn't want to dine indoors. We went to Greenwood Supper Club, great little supper club, long-established supper club in Door County. And they had outdoor dining that they'd set up temporarily on their lawn. And man, we got there not long after they opened on a Friday night for a fish fry. It was probably about 5:15 when we got there. And by the time we left at 6:30, we were still comfortable, but it was getting pretty chilly out there. So yeah, that's going to be the challenge that a lot of these restaurants and taverns are going to face when we get into the cold weather months. But they're looking at some ways to deal with those challenges too.
What are some of the ways that they're trying to work around the fact that you can't really be outside safely?
Well, here's how they're dealing with it, or planning to deal with it. In some cases, they're using those portable heaters, which I think we've all become familiar with. A lot of restaurants had started using them, restaurants and taverns, during the chillier months in the fall and spring. So you've got that as a possibility. The other possibility is doing certain structural changes. The recent story I wrote about this topic, I talked to Mike Idle. Mike runs Nomad World Pub, which just finished its 20th year, I believe it is, on Brady Street. And Mike is talking about doing things like installing some wind walls and some kind of partial covers on his large outdoor patio. Not strictly putting it all indoors, but trying to provide some kind of windbreak or cover as the weather gets colder.
Do we know how that squares with regulations in general? Because now it seems like you're really effectively inside.
Well, I think that's the key. I think Mike and people like him are trying to do this in a way that it doesn't become a quote unquote indoor space. That they're still keeping it as an outdoor space, because frankly, that's again what patrons want. A lot of them don't want to be indoors while still trying to somehow cut down on the wind and cut down on, who knows, perhaps even the snow. Here's the other thing that might happen, and I say might because so far this is something that would require an act of the Common Council and the mayor, and I haven't seen that officially happen yet as a proposal. But that program I talked about earlier, the one that allows conversion of parking lanes and in some cases street lanes to outdoor dining, that typically expires on November 15th. That could be extended. Now, that would, again, require an act of the Common Council and the mayor to do that. But that's been suggested, I know, by some people, including Chris Socha, who's an architect here in town who works with restaurant tavern owners on these types of issues. So maybe conceivably we'll get a proposal for the Common Council to allow that to go into the winter. That is, in addition to requiring some of those heat lamps, perhaps some of those wind barriers, I think the bigger thing that's going to require is a real change in attitude as to how we, as Wisconsin residents, approach winter. And there are examples of cities where that has sort of been embraced and celebrated. I can tell by your reaction that you're a little bit skeptical about this whole notion, which is understandable. We know how cold it can get here, but you know, there are ways of adapting to things, and human beings, if nothing else, are wonderfully adaptable.
Yeah. Now, to take a bit of a step back, you know, we've talked about the fact that restaurants have been closing during this time. And there are certain kinds of restaurants that have been having a lot more difficulty than others, and some eating establishments that have been doing relatively well during the pandemic. Can you unpack that a bit? What kinds of, you know, parts of the restaurant sector are doing the most poorly and which are doing the best?
I think your fine dining establishments may be finding it more difficult to pivot to carry out just by the nature of their product. For example, it's really no big deal to carry out burgers, pizza. I mean, even a fish fry, I think, is relatively portable. But if you start getting into things like filet mignon or a really well-done fresh fish that requires a lot of presentation, that experience, you know, it gets diminished by carryout. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And that's why in some cases, I think some of these finer dining establishments have tried to adjust their menus accordingly to perhaps at least temporarily include some items that are more friendly to carryout. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and I just did a story about this, is food halls. Food halls like Milwaukee Public Market, Mequon Public Market, Crossroads Collective, which is over at on the east side at Farwell North Avenues. Food halls nationwide have generally been performing pretty well, even as all these independent standalone restaurants are closing. And we actually have two food halls that are currently under development that are to open in Milwaukee in the spring of 2021. A very large one called Third Street Market Hall that'll be at the former Grand Avenue. The construction on that was delayed for a while, but it started up in August. And a small food hall called North Avenue Market that'll be on North Avenue near the Tosa-Milwaukee border, where a former bank branch is going to be converted into a small food hall. And part of what's going on there is the economics of food halls. A lot of them tend to have central kitchens. And if you are a restaurant operator, you can open at a food hall often for a lot less than you would do as a standalone restaurant. A lot of the investment is being done by the landlord of the food hall as opposed to you as the restaurant operator slash tenant. And so that gives you an opportunity. It gives opportunities to startups, for one thing. It also gives an opportunity for established restaurants to open areas where they can experiment with different concepts, perhaps do pop-ups. As a matter of fact, Crossroads Collective had a pop-up Laotian restaurant open this summer called Thum, T-H-U-M, and it just re-upped for a two-year lease. So it's going to be there beyond that initial temporary period.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how restaurants fare as we get into these colder months. But Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, bon appetit.
Tom Dakin covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor. Much like local restaurants, WUWM is also preparing for what promises to be an eventful autumn, due in no small part to the November election. Our region and our country is facing an extraordinary array of challenges, from public health to the economy, inequality, and criminal justice. There has never been a time when it's been more important to stand up for solid, fearless journalism that insists on truth, transparency, and really accountability. And that is what you get at WUWM. That is why I'm asking for your support during this fall member drive. The number to call is 877-583-0309. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or press the red donate button on the app. WUWM is really fueled by your generous support and guided by our mission to bring you information, ideas, and inspiration to build a community of listeners who learn, respect, and act in ways that strengthen and benefit one another. We're inviting you to be a part of that community with your important donation now. Call 877-583-0309. You can go to our website, wuwm.com/give, or press that red donate button on the app. And thank you so much for your support. We'll take one last break, then hear some new music from local artists for this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Although there haven't been many live shows since the pandemic hit the U.S. last March, Milwaukee bands have somehow found a way to release new music. That's been great for Matt Wild, who every month releases a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which describes itself as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. He joins me every month to share with us a sample of what he's been listening to for the Milwaukee Music Roundup. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me back, Joy. It's good to be here virtually.
So as we talked about a bit before the interview, September is kind of a crazy month, especially for people who have kids. And it seems like really for everyone who's involved in education, even tangentially, has that impacted the amount of music that's been coming out? Do you feel like you've seen less, or have you seen about the same amount?
You know, we were just talking about this the other day in the office at Milwaukee Record here, the illustrious Milwaukee Record offices. And it I don't want to, you know, say one way or the other for sure, but it does seem that things are kind of, you know, slowing down a little bit with releases. There's still a ton to listen to and to think about and to write about. and to talk about. But, you know, there was kind of that burst of quarantine creativity, right, you know, around March and April. And I think, you know, like everyone's just been so ground down by everything in the past few months that things are kind of cooling off a little. So, like I said, it's not like it's come to a complete halt, thank goodness. But yeah, maybe I think people are just, you know, people are just exhausted, myself included, let's be honest.
I think we all feel a bit that way. So luckily for us, we're still getting a lot of great releases, even if we're seeing fewer of them. This first song on the list, it actually comes from a couple of artists that I think will be familiar to longtime Lake Effect listeners. And the song you've chosen, at least to me, it's one of those songs that when you hear it, you know, you really just want to sing along to it.
It is one of those songs where I had to double and then triple check to make sure that this was not like an old standard, right? It has that feel like I must have heard this song before, but it is in fact an original song. The song is Don't You Ever Change, and it's written by a longtime Milwaukee singer-songwriter, Peter Mulvey, and he co-wrote it with another longtime Milwaukee singer-songwriter, John Seeger. And this performance is a collaboration with Peter and Sister Strings. Sister Strings, for folks that don't know, are sisters. It is Monique and Shanti Ross. And they are kind of this incredible, classically trained cello and violin duo. They've been kicking around now for a couple of years, and they're just fantastic. And this is a collaboration between them and Peter Mulvey that I really didn't see coming. And I was delighted when I saw their names together, and I was even more delighted when I listened to this song. To sweeten the pot even further, it is a live recording. This is coming from an upcoming 18-song double album, a live album called Live at the Cafe Carpe, and all between Peter Mulvey and Sister Strings. And this was recorded over two nights back in January of 2020, back in, you know, when things were semi-regular, when people still could play live. So now, all these many months later, it's fantastic to actually listen to a live recording of musicians in a live setting and hear like people clap at the end. What a strange sound that is. Peter talks about that this was a song that he wrote a couple years ago, actually, with John Seeger. And it was one of those songs that he kind of forgot about for a while and then rediscovered and was like, oh, I wrote this? Oh, this is great. Let's record it. And so, like I said, yes, this is a live recording of it. It's from an upcoming album called Live at the Cafe Carpe. It is Peter Mulvey and Sister Strings performing Don't You Ever Change.
Don't you change on me. Don't you ever change. Don't you change on me. Don't you change. Cause if you ever change, if you change on me, if you ever change, it would rain on me. Don't you change. Love was everything that they told me it would be. Everything they told me, but I wouldn't listen. Baby, are you listening to me?
Don't You Ever Change by Peter Mulvey, performed by Peter Mulvey and Sister Strings. Now, this next song, it has actually quite a lot packed into it, including a few different artists, but also some really different genres that they're playing with. Tell us a bit about this.
The next song we're going to be listening to is called Friday Night, and it is by, we were just talking about a sister duo, Sister Strings, and this is by a brother duo called Immortal Girlfriend. This is brothers William and Kevin Bush, And they've been around maybe since 2017 or so, and they've put out a couple of records and a couple of EPs. They have a new one that came out this past spring called Ride, and they are fantastic. It is very much a electro, retro, synthy kind of project between William and Kevin. And they've collaborated with a lot of people over the past few years. And this one in particular is a collaboration with two Texas-based artists, Haley Orion and Deezy Brown. And you're right, there is a lot packed into this song. It's Haley Orion with kind of lead vocals throughout. Deezy Brown kind of comes in later with a rap verse. And it's, I really love Immortal Girlfriend. They've always had this very atmospheric, very moody, neon-drenched kind of vibe that I've always associated with summer. And listening to this now in fall, I realize it kind of works for fall too. So I've added this to kind of my moody, gothy, Halloween, fall playlist that I listen to like all the time when I'm walking around outside and the leaves have changed, and it really puts me in a mood. So thank you, Immortal Girlfriend, for doing this. And like I said, I think it's a great song. Very the thing that Immortal Girlfriend does the best. And adding these two other artists in, I think, is a really nice mix. It is Friday Night by Immortal Girlfriend.
Friday Night by Immortal Girlfriend. Now, this next song, I wasn't familiar with the group, and I had a hard time kind of figuring out the genre of this song, and when I was looking at it on SoundCloud, the first hashtag that came up was trip hop. So tell us a bit about this. The band is called You Win. It then has three exclamation points at the end. I don't know if it's like that old group, Chick Chick Chick.
That's what I thought of too. Yes, it is a brand new project. So if you haven't heard of them or have trouble finding out a lot about them, you're not alone, because this is a kind of a brand new project. It is, the name of the project is You Win Space 3! I think that's the proper way to write it all out. This is a collaboration between two artists who have worked together before, Amanda Huff and William Gardner, who releases music under the name This Random Machine. Now, they've worked together on some of Amanda's solo projects in the past. Amanda Huff, she's been around for a few years now too, and has just this incredible voice, and she has worked with William before, but this is kind of the first kind of official pairing, and they're, you know, calling themselves You Win Space 3! The name of the song is another doozy. It's Shrapnel, but it's Shrap.NEL. So just to make sure we got all that right. And yes, they describe themselves as a trip-hop / dark pop duo. And I really like their description for this particular track. They say, the track dances between serpentine playfulness and manic delight, written from the perspective of a godlike figure toying with a mortal imposter. I don't know, what more can you say for that? That's a pretty great description and a pretty great song. This is You Win! Three of them exclamation points. And the song is called Shrapnel.
You can take pieces is, but you can't take form. God blames our shrapnel, our costume, our falls. Do you understand? Subtract and you lose. You made your mistake. Your perfume.
Shrapnel from You Win! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. This next band has a more straightforward name. I also think, you know, it's kind of a hard left turn in terms of genre, but it's exactly what you'd expect from a band called Fuzzy Surf. So tell us a bit about this.
Fuzzy Surf is one of those bands, again, has been around for a couple of years now and has been consistently putting out, I think, some of the best guitar pop music in the city, among the best. I really, really like this group a lot. I really, really like their videos. If you haven't seen any of the Fuzzy Surf videos, go to YouTube right now, check them out, just type in Fuzzy Surf and you will be delighted with, I don't know, at this point, maybe like a dozen, I don't know, they have a ton of videos. And there's a lot of puppets involved, there's a lot of animation involved, a lot of stop motion animation. These guys are just kind of endlessly creative with their videos. In that way, they kind of remind me of like a group like, you know, OK Go or something that you're, you know, really well known for their videos. And that's not to say that Fuzzy Surf's music is lesser than their videos, but just in case you want to really be entertained by some great local videos, check out Fuzzy Surf. This song that we're going to be talking about and listening to is called You Belong in My Arms. It is from their new record, their third record. It's called Sweet Tooth, and a very aptly named record. It is a, like I said, just some really great, solid pop, guitar pop, songwriting, and production. This record in particular is a real, I think, big step forward for the group. It's just such a lushly produced record, and certainly their best sounding record, I think, that they've ever put out. I'll quote them here on what they were going for with this record as well. They say, while writing and planning this collection of songs, the band set out to create a syrupy saccharine pop album, which was still geared for the anti-pop among us. We wanted to poke fun at the increasing importance of image and controversy over substance in the modern music industry and social media while still putting out a genuine and timeless musical statement. That's a lot to dig into, but I think they succeeded. It is a wonderfully poppy album. The song we're going to be listening to has a real kind of throwback 60s, kind of Phil Spector, Wall of Sound kind of vibe to it. And like I said, this album, front to back, is fantastic. It's Sweet Tooth. You're going to hear a lot of songs like this. You're going to hear a lot of songs that have kind of a maybe like a Weezer or the Rentals vibe from the 90s. And I don't know, just a delight to hear these guys. And like I said before, if you haven't seen their videos, check those videos out. But the song we'll be listening to now is You Belong in My Arms by Fuzzy Surf. We'll be right back.
That was You Belong in My Arms by Fuzzy Surf. Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and joins us to talk about a few of those songs. You can find our previous conversations with Wild at WUWM.com. Lake Effect and WUWM are committed to bringing you these kinds of conversations that connect you with our community. Sometimes that means listening to music coming from local musicians. Sometimes that means hearing from local politicians and newsmakers. But it always means bringing you engaging conversations that illuminate the world around us. We are living through an extraordinary time, and WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, is committed to connecting you with expanded, essential coverage that you need to meet the challenges of our time. And the only way we can bring you that coverage is with your support. So please, don't delay making your commitment to public radio during our fall member drive. Call us at 877-583-0309. That number is 877-583-0309. You can go to our website, wuwm.com/give, or press that red donate button on the app. Your support makes all the difference. And that is today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.